Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and I have the honour today to speak to Professor Michael Davis. His latest book is Freedom Undone, The Assault on Liberal Values and Institutions in Hong Kong. It was published by the Association for Asian Studies in 2024, so it's a really recent book hot off the press. Now, just to introduce our guests today, Professor Davis is a former long-term professor at the University of Hong Kong, and prior to that, at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, where he taught courses on human rights and constitutional development until the fall of 2020. He's currently a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a senior research associate at the Wenahead East Asia Institute at Columbia University, and a professor of law and international affairs at OP Jindal Global University in India. Professor Michael Davis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jane. It's my pleasure.
It's great to have you. So just to get us started, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write your latest book, Freedom Undone, The Assault on Liberal Values and Institutions in Hong Kong?
Well, thank you for the question. As your introduction suggested, I spent most of my adult life in Hong Kong, and so I was very privileged to be directly involved in almost all the developments coming out of the handover of Hong Kong to China, both before and after. And so I felt that gave me a special position to be able to know what was going on, not just in a very distant academic sort of way, but also through direct involvement. And so I had written a shorter book, which you covered on this network as well, about 4 years ago now. And that book was just at the time when the national security law was being imposed on Hong Kong. And I was speculating as to what was happening. And it was a very short book, but it sort of highlighted some of the things, the concerns I had. Well, then more recently, the publishers, which are a combination of the Association of Asian Studies and Columbia University Press, they were interested in whether I would be willing to update that. And I said, well, it's so much has happened that it's just simply updating or revising is not going to do the trick. So I decided to offer to them to write a whole new book on it. I used some of the background from the earlier short book, but more or less get more into all the weeds and things and developments since. So this is, for me, on a personal level, as you asked the question, it's a work of passion in a sense, because I was so much a part of Hong Kong society, as I know you were in the past as well. I was a voter there, was in effect a citizen of that society, and participated in public life because as a constitutional law professor and a human rights professor, you're called upon all the time, at least in the past in Hong Kong, not so much today, to participate in the public debate and to do interviews and so on and explain what's going on. So I thought this was an important, juncture, if you will, that to try to bring this story to the wider world for them to understand it. And then we can talk more. I'll wait for your questions, but we can talk more about what I want to accomplish with the book.
Yeah, so just for listeners, Michael's previous book was Making Hong Kong China, The Rollback of Human Rights and the Rule of Law, and I will post a link in the show notes to that, so you can actually also listen to that interview. I guess then it is the right time to think about between that book in 2020 and this book in February 2024 of this year. You know, can you tell me about some of the changes and what you were trying to accomplish in this later book?
Well, when I've been giving book talks lately, I think a very short quote, I use this very short quote to start my book talks from Chow Hung Tong. And this quote's in the book, very short. And it just says that what's happening in Hong Kong, and she, by the way, I should say, wrote this in prison, as a statement upon receiving a human rights award that I was one of the nominators for, actually. It was irrelevant to this. But she said, what's happening in Hong Kong is not an anomaly, but a warning. And so that's one thing that drives the book, the idea that you have this illiberal model being imposed on a very highly developed liberal constitutional system. And so that Hong Kong, under the onslaught of the mainland imposed national security law, and after that, now just this past week, the Article 23 legislation, which is a local national security law, you have this dramatic imposition on the society. And so I couldn't say this so much in 2024, but now it's very clear that this change has been so dramatic that Hong Kong has been transformed from a liberal constitutional order to an illiberal one. And this is the basis of Chow Hung Kong's warning that China's agenda, you know, under its national security regime, is one that tries to support illiberal systems over liberal ones. And this is a global debate. It's not all about China. It's about also the politics in England, the politics in Europe, in the United States, and countries around the world that people, as in the jargon of the day, populist leaders are promoting illiberal agendas, attacking courts, the things that check democracy and so on. So all of this is going on worldwide, and Hong Kong is like a poster child almost of this. I kind of think, and I wish I could write as well, but Tocqueville used in long ago, writing about democracy in America, wasn't really writing about democracy in America. He was writing about what democracy should look like in terms of consulting with people and so on. So in this sense, this is almost a negative version using a city. You could call it a city-state, although it's not technically a state, but using what looks like a city-state, a separate jurisdiction, as an example of an illiberal model that China wants to promote. And so the second thing that struck me in writing the book was just how comprehensive and well-planned China's crackdown has been. It leaves very little to chance. And now the addition this past week of the new Article 23 legislation makes that even more clear. And I talk about that in the book briefly because I was able to just before publication. So this is one part of it. And then I'm asked frequently, what, you know, does it matter anymore? Is Hong Kong just lost? It's another mainland city. And I don't think that's the right answer. First, there's very important to expose this kind of thing, human rights, the transformation of society. It's important for the people there that their story be told and understood, and maybe a door held open, at least in our thoughts, of trying to change it and do something about it. And I think there's a lot of concern in that regard, because if you think about the sort of emerging Cold War, as it were, between China and the United States, it's like this intense global debate where countries align either in favor of liberal values or against it. So it has huge importance to understand what this looks like, not just for Hong Kong, but beyond Hong Kong, which is, of course, the basis of Chow Hung Tong's comment about it being a warning. So I think it's very important in that regard. And I think for people now still being tried in the courts and people being arrested and future arrests that may occur under the new legislation, I think it's important to them as well that we're following this and monitoring it. So I dismiss the argument that, well, Hong Kong is lost, get over it. I'm not ready to get over what's happening to this society.
And I think you do in your book capture some of the changes that have happened. You know, you write about the progress, sort of, I'd say, slower progress until 2020. But then in 2020, with the introduction of the national security law, this sort of acceleration of this erosion of rights and freedoms, which we can now see. And the the sort of extent of it. When you open the book, you provide this really, really great description when you write about, you know, imagine you live in one of the world's freest, most open cities, a global center of finance, education, and culture, and you go on and talk about this. Perhaps you can touch on some of the changes that have occurred between 2020 and the present day under the national security law.
Well, sadly, the biggest change is silence. Hong Kong was so vibrant over the many years that I was privileged to be there. I arrived in 1985. It was right after the Sino-British Treaty had been signed, and Hong Kong was still a colony of Britain, as it remained until 1997. And meanwhile, there was emerging a politics in Hong Kong. I remember my first class in Hong Kong at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, just asking my undergraduate students whether they liked the Sino-British Treaty or what would they do. And their first response was to reject my question, saying that no one ever asked us. Our voice is not allowed. Only China and Britain agreed to this. And then I says, well, humor me, what would you do? And it was an interesting response, which was kind of part of some of the public discussion at the time, that they would have Hong Kong return to China and then hire the British to run it, which is kind of a strange response, but an understandable one, which told me, and I think anyone who hears it, that they had an identification with China as ethnic Chinese people, but they didn't trust the Chinese government to run the society as an open society that they cared for and cherished. And so I think that that's has had a sense of impact on me. But then when you think about going forward, they finally do come up with this basic law. This treaty required there be a basic law. In the early chapters of the book, I talk about the Sino-British Joint Declaration and the basic law. And I try to keep it relatively short. It's something that we've heard a lot about over time, but basically get to the essence of it. And there was a lot of politics going on as this process was unfolding in the 1990s. There was a concern that democratic change was not going fast enough. And there was a British governor, Chris Patten, there, who was promoting a more aggressive change in that regard, recognizing that, I think as I'd heard him, that he felt that Hong Kong people needed to experience more democracy if they were going to be able to defend themselves after the handover and to be able to stand up for their values and so on, that hiring the British to run it was no longer an option, that you had to develop politics. So he did so at great risk because he was vilified a lot by the Chinese government, and I think to some extent even by his own foreign office, where a Sinologist there were more accommodating to what they thought China required. So that was a situation, and on the street, Hong Kong people were finding their voice. And they were taking to the streets and protesting. Of course, they did that dramatically in 1989. But they continued, you know, to carry on this way. So the basic law was then drafted. And I point out in the book that it had two flaws. One is that the ultimate power to interpret it was with the National People's Congress Standing Committee. So that was one. And the other one that was that the promise of universal suffrage was met with a lot of foot dragging and Beijing intervention to really stop that from happening. So then this created a tension between Hong Kong and Beijing that I had not seen so much when I arrived in 1985. That tension was Hong Kong people's recognition that Beijing would use its power to contain democratic development in Hong Kong, and the Hong Kong people themselves viewed democracy as the only way they could defend their autonomy, that the government that the Chinese put in place at the handover in 1997 was one that answered more to Beijing than it did to Hong Kong people. And so this created these two flaws, I think, explain almost all the protests that would follow all the way up until this crackdown in 2020. So then over the years, as Hong Kong people kept demanding the promised universal suffrage, and that kept being delayed, there were protests, we know, at various times. One was in after the handover, the first one was in 2003, over Article 23 legislation. There were also a health crisis emerging, over COVID and mask wearing and so on. So SARS, I should say, not COVID. Get my diseases correct here. Over SARS. And it's kind of interesting that then the next time they try to do this thing, there's COVID, another health crisis. So that's a coincidence of sorts. But in any event, so this is what was going on. And so as people kept protesting the Article 23 version, at the time, there were nine of us. I talk about this in the book because it's something I experienced directly. There were nine of us in a room just looking at the government's proposed bill in 2003, and we were worried about it because we felt that under the principles in the Joint Declaration and the Basic Law, which includes the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, that any drafting of national security laws should be very human rights conscious. It should be a reform of the colonial laws in that area, rather than harsher laws. And the government wasn't putting forth a kind of reform legislation. And so we wrote a bunch of pamphlets and went to the street, basically distributing them. And we didn't imagine such a following would emerge, but eventually 500,000 protesters were on the streets. I remember passing out these pamphlets. We were all there at that time, senior lawyers and a couple academics just doing our community service. We weren't trying to orchestrate anything particularly, except to make public awareness and create some pressure on the government to listen to our concerns. So that was a kind of thing that was happening. There was a civil human rights fund formed at the time that would do the applications and stuff for protests. So this was going on. And this is how protests would repeat themselves. The next one would be over so-called patriotic education. And then we saw a whole new generation emerge, Joshua Wong, Nathan Law, and Alex Chow, and others, Agnes Chow, all these people coming out, young people, really in high school, trying to demand that liberal education be maintained and that they not have brainwashing as they saw it. That again was an initiative that Hong Kong government carried out sort of at Beijing's guidance, because Beijing was concerned about young people in Hong Kong not being patriotic enough. And so that was 2012. And then 2014 and 15, in the intervening years, Beijing had signaled that the promised universal suffrage might be possible. But then Hong Kong worried that Beijing would not allow a genuine free elections. And so there was mobilization led by a group organizing something called Occupy Central. And again, why are the public protesting? It's not just about democracy. It's about the rule of law, their core values. So there's a sense that the Hong Kong government by then was not up to guarding Hong Kong's autonomy, and that it was too easily giving in to whatever Beijing might say. No one expected it to go to war with Beijing, but they expected it to have a voice to guard and protect Hong Kong's values. And I can say the rule of law was the highest value for Hong Kong people in opinion polls of the day. What looked like a democracy protest was more than that. It was a protest over guarding the city's autonomy, maintaining the rule of law and basic freedoms. And democracy was seen as instrumental to get a government that would speak up about these things. I don't think, and Beijing seemingly was not comfortable with that kind of thing. So it was constraining democracy, democratic development, and claiming there had to be gradual and orderly progress in all of this. So this was the tension. But I put this tension, at the end of the day, Beijing's going to blame it on Hong Kong's protesters and accuse them of a color revolution. But I put the source of this tension not on the protesters. Actually, Hong Kong protesters until 2019 were always nonviolent in their strategies. Even those 2014-15 protests, Occupy Central, that became the umbrella movement, was nonviolent. It was that these elites in Hong Kong, the establishment, the pro-Beijing elites, who failed to convey Hong Kong concerns and help this model one country, two systems to work. That's where I would lay the cause ultimately of the breakdown in relations between Hong Kong people and the central government. And so the more people demanded the kinds of changes that were promised in the basic law, the more that tension emerged. And at the end of the day, then in 2019, the big protest when the government, again at Beijing's bidding, is promoting an extradition law that would allow people to be extradited to the mainland. And then instead of listening and responding, they eventually withdrew that bill. But at the in the interim, 1 million, 2 million protesters were on the street. So these are things that are happening that ultimately result in Beijing taking a heavy hand towards Hong Kong. At first in this protest, instead of listening and talking in a way and coming to a solution, the government seemed to turn the problem over to the police. And the police had no power to negotiate any kind of substantive outcome. So they just essentially ratcheted up enforcement in many ways with violence that was shown on the evening news every day worldwide. And this, the young people then start becoming more violent as well. There was violence among the young. It wasn't the dominant thing. Most of the protests, millions would march, and a few on the margins would be throwing rocks. We're not talking about armed rebellion. We're talking about kids throwing rocks. And so this is not a color revolution by any stretch. And at the end of the day, they cracked down on that aggressively. And then in 2020, we delivered this national security law.
Just before we move on to talk more about the national security law, I'm wondering if you can comment a bit more about why there was such fury in 2019. You know, you've talked about the protests, you know, 2003, 2012, 2014, that were all peaceful. And then suddenly it was almost like an eruption in 2019. And they seemed to be this sort of pivotal change where the protests went on pretty much, you know, for, was it 8 or 9 months until COVID, you know, was almost, you could argue, was able to be weaponized by the Hong Kong government to quell the protests. Why was there this sort of shift, would you say?
I think it was more about frustration on the one hand, but also the police tactics on the other. So these things came together. The protest in early June, there was 1 million people marching against the extradition bill, and the government dismissed that out of hand, their demands. And then in the middle of June of 2019, the protest grew dramatically, the largest one actually ever in Hong Kong, one of the largest in the world, about 2 million people. And again, that was ignored. And then when protesters were gathering outside of the Legislative Council after that, and they broke the windows and stuff, and they got inside, and they even wrote on the wall a slogan that you taught us that nonviolence doesn't work, that you don't listen to us. And so I think, and this is the youngsters, you know, in a way, they weren't there in 2003 protesting, but they were, a lot of them, in 2012 and in 2014. first as very young protesters over patriotic education, and then in the umbrella movement, which kind of took over the Occupy Central campaign and replaced it in a way, because I was actually there that night just observing in the station that the police were blocking people from crossing over a bridge to where the protest was at. And so eventually people, I guess there was all this internet summons to come protest and join it. And the crowd became quite large, and they pushed over the barriers the police had put, went onto the street. So that's how come it became 79 days in the middle of one of the busiest streets in Hong Kong. And when they were over there, there was gassing of them and the umbrellas over their heads. They took out a kind of umbrella Hong Kongers often carry in a tropical climate because it rains a lot. And they were protecting themselves, and so it became the umbrella movement. These youngsters were very much active in the 2019 protest eventually. And I think they were highly frustrated, but I think observing the police over the process, also a kind of violence they see playing out on television, they became more active. And they developed various factions over whether violence was used or not. Some of the leaders, the more senior leaders that were arrested, were actually against violence and had long led protests with violence. But some of the young felt that that wasn't getting us nowhere, that the Beijing simply won't listen. And so I think there were some, there was that kind of response. If the police had not been so violent, I'm not sure if this would have taken on so much speed in developing a kind of rock-throwing strategies and taking up bricks and doing this and that and building barriers and what against the police's attack. So it became, the police became in some ways like another gang on the street. And so the tension, this wasn't the best way to manage the problem. So you can sort of, I suppose if you're talking about a bunch of youngsters and the government, and then the government doesn't handle it well, it may be that the government should be held accountable for the way things develop, even though the youngsters were certainly exercising agency, those that were involved in throwing rocks and stuff on the margins, and they, all kinds of internet things were going back and forth and sharing information about where to go and what to do. So they also took up some agency. So it's sort of a little bit on both sides of that.
And then, of course, in 2020, just before midnight on the 30th of June, the national security law was introduced in Hong Kong. So tell me what changed then, you know, what was different between the 30th of June and 1st of July, and what happened after that?
Well, the 1st of July, it became clear that the government was going to use this law. It wasn't something out there. There's kind of a warning to people, you know, be mindful, we've got a new, tougher law. So Beijing had signaled about a month earlier in a meeting of the National People's Congress and so on that there was going to be such a law, but the government had not, allegedly had not seen it. We don't know the truth because the relationship between this appointed Hong Kong government and Beijing officials is very opaque. But Carrie Lam claimed she hadn't seen the law until the day it was issued. And what goes on there is the first step in what now, and that's why all the developments after it tell a bigger story than the original text that we had in our hands when we were talking about the last book. And what really was starting to happen is Beijing is transferring its system of national security into Hong Kong. And for that, I discuss a lot in the first chapter of the book about Beijing's strategies regarding national security, and elsewhere in the book as well, that it's a it's famously, in comparison to liberal democracies tend to see national security more through the lens of foreign, like military threats. Nowadays, some of that internet kind of warfare as well. But at least it's actual attacks. Where China's version of national security, we describe as an internal one. And that version sees the biggest threat to the leadership, actually, not even to the country, but to the government, the party in charge, the Communist Party, is coming from the Chinese people themselves. The leaders of China have read the political economy literature, and they know that when a country develops a certain stage, the people might demand change. So the orientation of their national security agenda is to inhibit that, to make sure that doesn't happen. And to do that, they have to snuff out, frankly, in simple terms, they have to snuff out liberal ideas, the ideas that of a free press, of constitutionalism, and so on. Even as early as 2013, I believe it was, they issued a document, number 9, forbidding people from teaching constitutionalism, free press, Western notions of democracy, and so on. So that literally the regime tries to stop this discussion entirely. So when they impose a national security law on Hong Kong, in effect, it's in that model. And so it talks about, you know, subversion and secession, terrorism, and collusion. But all of these things, what is subversive? Subversive is the promotion of these ideas in the Chinese vision. And so that's snuffed out really entirely on the mainland. But now we're seeing that vision take over in Hong Kong, first with the national security law, but now with the Article 23 legislation, it's getting more explicit that it is the mainland system that's being adopted. And we can talk about the Article 23 legislation in this regard. But then what happens is the very first day, July 1st, they're already arrested under the national security law. And the very first trial under the national security law results from the arrest of Ong Ying Kit, who's driving a motorcycle in an area near some, you know, annual protests on July 1st. And he's driving a motorcycle there and drives into a police barrier, apparently causing some minor injuries. And he's carrying a flag, "Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times." This is a slogan that was used throughout the 2019 protest. So it's basically a protest slogan. And he's arrested. And when he's tried, he's eventually convicted of this kind of subversion. And he's also convicted of terrorism simply for riding a motorcycle. And so the book talks about these kinds of things as some of the initial items. And it was interesting to me when I read the judgment in his case that even though the national security law itself in Article 4 says that the rights will continue to be protected in various rights, the ICCPR and all of that, there was no mention of rights in his judgment. And so that's sort of the signal of what's to come, both the arrest that day. There were several hundred other arrests for public order offenses as well that day. But clearly the government showed that it was going to take it seriously. Meanwhile, the officials were all claiming, no, this is only going to reach a minority of people. They also claimed that this past week over the new Article 23 law. Except what they do is they actually go after people, especially high-profile people, in a way that tells everyone else to go silent, that don't say anything, because it's a strategy for arresting the few to silence the many. and arresting them over trivial things. Like there were some arrests that year over I forget what the profession was, but they published a book,
The speech therapists.
The sheep and wolves.
Yeah.
And the government clearly, it was a children's book, clearly knew the wolves were the Hong Kong government and the sheep were the people. But at the end of the day, it's kind of a harmless thing. And these people are charged with sedition. One of the things that happened after the national security law is the government mobilized an old colonial sedition law as well to prosecute people. And the same limitations of the national security law were applied to the sedition, the colonial law, because the national security law provides special processes and procedures for national security cases. It doesn't say for cases under the national security law, but all national security cases. And so we know that the same is going to apply to the new Article 23 legislation, which any prosecutions would be national security cases. So this is kind of how it starts. And we can talk about the what follows on that. But the very first day, I think the memo was out. Stay silent, no more protest, and the government officials would use language about color revolutions and all this to show that there was no more tolerance for this. And we know the community response was a lot of. Opposition organizations started disbanding. People that weren't arrested, some would leave Hong Kong. Hong Kong changed dramatically. So that it's important, I think, to appreciate that the national security law is itself of constitutional stature in Hong Kong now, because it's a mainland issued law. It says on its face that all local laws must conform to the national security law. So the only question was, does it override the basic law? And the answer to that came very quickly in a bail case involving Jimmy Lai, where the court says, well, there's a conflict between the common law practice of presumption of bail and the national security law creates a presumption against bail. And so that's an exception. So what happens is very clearly start saying that any conflict between the national security law and the basic law will be resolved in favor of the national security law. And so the national security law, even though it didn't follow the basic law procedures, it is an amendment of the basic law. And so we can say on that day, Hong Kong was transformed from a liberal constitutional order to a national security order.
And so perhaps this is a good time to pick up on the point that you've just alluded to, the way that the new Article 23 is really explicit in instituting Beijing's conception of national security in Hong Kong. Can you tell me more about this?
Oh, absolutely. And I did have a chance to add that into the book the day before the book was launched. Only had 300 page words, so I gave a paragraph that at least I can highlight that the new Article 23 proposals, because they started with a consultation document, and the consultation document made very clear that it was going to conform to the central government, to the mainland version of national security. So the document in the first chapter cites with praise the mainland so-called comprehensive national security concept, which is called a holistic approach. And so the Hong Kong government says, we're going to adopt the same holistic approach in this consultation document. And then they cite under that approach, the mainland identifies, as I mentioned earlier, the mainland notion of national security focuses mostly on internal developments in the society. And so they cite the mainland law includes some 20-some categories of human behavior that are areas where national security risk may occur. And so the new consultation on national security cites the same categories. And then it has various areas. The new law has various areas that it addresses. For example, one is state secrets. And this state secret concept is actually the mainland term for, laws where you offend government secrecy requirements. And in doing so, they essentially adopt the whole text of mainland law regarding state secrets. And it then, because the national security is internally focused in so many categories, it explicitly says that you're exposing the government's policies on economic and social development, for example, is an area of state secrets, and you can face very severe punishments. I haven't memorized all the different punishments, but they vary depending on things. But now these things can involve 14 years in jail, 7 years in jail, in prison, and so on. So very harsh punishments are attached to exposing state secrets. But what that does is the state secret requirement sends a warning to journalists and academics that digging too deep into government policy might get you in trouble. And I've been asked by many reporters, what do they mean by social and economic developments that are secrets? And I don't know the answer. And that's the point. These categories are designed that people can't really know what's in and what's out. There's the red line is we don't know where it is. And I know I'm not alone in that regard. And I've heard others comment on it as well, that we just don't know when you've crossed that red line. And I think that's the design of the national security regime, so that people are sort of cowered into silence because they dare not speak up. So they held a consultation with this document for 1 month, a very short period, and they claimed to have like 98% approval of the society, obviously because people in the pro-Beijing camp submitted a bunch of, approving statements that were that. And then there was a minority of organizations in exile that submitted criticisms, but those were simply condemned in the government's final analysis as being anti-China forces. So the view then they take is that society almost unanimously supports what they're doing. And so that's kind of the way they've handled it. And why is it that no one who was there locally spoke up? It's because I think the general view in the public is that if you criticize the national security law in any way other than the most innocuous way and, that's safe, that you could wind up being approached by police and arrested. So this is, I think, the design of how it works. So they have other areas. They now have updated that colonial sedition law, and they've increased it. Previously, only had a maximum 2-year sentence. Now, like the secrecy area, the sentences are much longer. And then they even also created the capacity for extended detention before you're tried. So not only can you get longer sentences after, but extended detention. And then they impose on people an obligation to report if anybody's doing anything that might be treason. Of course, no one knows what is treason. We don't know the red line. That was one of the offenses under the new law. And no one knows what it is. So how would you know if somebody else is doing it? And then if you're going to be punished up to 7 years for simply not ratting on somebody, then what do you do? Speculation is that this is designed to put pressure on relatives of dissidents who have fled, so that they're pressured to turn in their own family members and so on. And of course, they won't want to do that. And if they don't, then they risk being prosecuted there in Hong Kong. Again, putting more pressure on these exiles who have fled. So who knows? I mean, we can only speculate because they don't tell us. And then there's a lot of attention in the new Article 23 legislation to foreign interference or foreign organizations, foreign this, foreign that. Almost half of it is addressed in that way. And this, I think, goes very much to China's anxiety about liberal ideas, that what is the foreign interference? They've never shown any foreign interference except the promoting of human rights that are guaranteed under the UN Charter and the ICCPR, along with the liberal institutions of enforcement that those rights regimes assume. And so they're trying to cut all of that off. And so local people who interact with foreign collusion in some form or another are subject to harsh punishments. And so traditionally, Hong Kong even had, based in Hong Kong, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, all these NGOs that are well known to the world. And Hong Kong had local organizations that have all disbanded now that would sometimes receive funding and support to promote human rights in Hong Kong back when human rights were allowed to be promoted. But now those kinds of connections are clearly going to get you in trouble. And in the consultation document, they even mention kind of critically people who are fighting for human rights or monitoring human rights, are, I guess I should rephrase it, are engaging in political activity in the guise of fighting for human rights or monitoring for human rights. That's kind of how the sentence was formed, suggesting a very cynical view of human rights work. And then they had another point in the consultation document talked about so-called NGOs. So, you know, you can read the writing on the wall that human rights NGOs are operating at great risk now in regard to Hong Kong issues. And many of them have been attacked in the past, so they kind of know this. So that means what they're trying to do is cut off all traffic, like on the mainland of China, for human rights promotion entering into Hong Kong. And this is extremely contrary to the ICCPR and the Human Rights Committee, even without the new law, but under the mainland imposed law, already severely condemned the Hong Kong government for its policies and practices of arresting people and forcing closure of organizations. I should say as a footnote here that the national security law isn't just a criminal law. It also directs the Hong Kong government and offices of the mainland government to monitor education, the media, you know, all kinds of organizations and behavior that were long respected and admired in Hong Kong. These organizations are all to be monitored, the media especially. And so laws were created, for example, the public broadcaster that was modeled on the BBC, the RTHK, has new guidelines so that could be an official is appointed in charge of the public broadcaster now, and so that they can monitor it and make sure it becomes a kind of, government-friendly organization rather than a critical media, an independent media. And then other media organizations have been attacked, like the Apple Daily was one of the most prominent local Chinese language newspapers, was forced to close, and its boss, its owner, was arrested and is now on trial for subversion, sedition, and stuff of this nature. Jimmy Lai, I think a lot of the people in the world have heard of him. And so these things are done. And then political organizations that organized a primary election, 47 members were arrested and have been tried. We're waiting their sentences or whether they're convicted or not. We don't know the outcome of the trial. So this is not just, some of it gets into the criminal area, but the effort to regulate the media and shut it down is much broader than that. And the same on university campuses. They've imposed a requirement that they all, from kindergarten up, they teach national security. And so it's being promoted as the primary value of Hong Kong, even over Hong Kong's traditional values of being a, you know, a place of business and free markets and stuff. This national security agenda has taken over.
And then returning to this idea about foreign interference, you know, the picture that you've painted is pretty bleak so far, but, you know, at the start, you mentioned that there is still hope and that, you know, we shouldn't give up. And in fact, I think, you know, you do write about Hong Kong lobbyists being quite successful overseas at actually attracting the attention of foreign governments. So then I want to ask you about, you know, not just Hong Kong as a warning to the rest of the world, but what are the global implications of the national security law and how can the rest of the world respond?
Well, this is a challenge. That's exactly a lot of what the government's trying to snuff out in this new Article 23 legislation. That's why so much of it talks about foreign intelligence organizations, foreign interference, and so on, and disparages human rights organizations. And then they have collusion, talking about collusion with foreigners. Essentially, they're criminalizing human rights advocacy. And the law applies worldwide, both the national security law imposed by Beijing and the one enacted and passed and now in force in Hong Kong. It applies to the whole world. And so what they're doing, they're making all the advocacy abroad illegal, criminal. And they've put out warrants already on 13 young Hong Kongers who are in exile, who have fled Hong Kong. They have warrants against them and a bounty on their heads. And actually, there are more warrants than even the bounties. But we don't actually know how many they've put on their target list, because that's rather opaque. But the ones they announced in public as having bounties on them, and then they harassed their families, brought them into police stations to interrogate them and so on. So this national security agenda that we could speculate in 2020 looked like importing the mainland version. Now there's no ambiguity about that. Both the language and with the new Article 23 laws explicitly embracing the mainland national security, the holistic approach, that's clearly the aim. And so families get harassed as well. And so you're overseas now. You want to do something about it. You want to speak up. Well, what essentially happens is these young people just go ahead and they advocate. And I think as foreign, say, political bodies like parliaments and so on, they're going to have some backbone to be there to hear about these concerns and to make policy choices. So the Hong Konger in the UK, of course, there's Hong Kong Watch, which involves both British nationals and Hong Kongers. Study and follow what's going on in Hong Kong and issue comments. They work with parliamentary bodies to try to put pressure on the Chinese government and Hong Kong governments. This is human rights work. That's what it is. Human rights, being a human rights defender involves advocacy. If the advocacy is shut off at home, as it has been in Hong Kong now, with this national security regime, then the only avenue for drawing attention to it is overseas. And so they're criminalizing this. And what we are seeing are people just standing up against it. And so there are, in Britain, as I mentioned, Human Rights, Hong Kong Watch, and other human rights NGOs that approached the British Parliament. My own book was actually launched in Britain, in the British Parliament, hosted by Lord David Alton. And so this is what advocacy looks like in the face of repression, speaking truth to power, as people say. And so under the international human rights regime, all governments are obliged to speak up about human rights violations. While governments that violate human rights in extreme ways, and all governments violate it from time to time, and we're not perfect, But to the extent that it's so extreme as what I just described in Hong Kong, then there is actually an obligation on any members of the ICC, under the ICCPR and under the UN Charter, to speak up about it. And so advocates in overseas will be speaking up about it. But human rights organizations based overseas need to also find their voice and pay attention and to understand this as part of a broader trend right now that we face. Illiberal versus liberal debate is worldwide right now. And we have to pay attention. And what Hong Kong is in this worldwide discussion is it's probably one of the most dramatic cases, because it was, as you read from my book at the beginning, a fully developed modern city like New York or London that's being turned into a repressive security state. And so that is, I don't know if that's ever happened at that level before in terms of the social and political and legal development of a society and its transformation. We have horror stories all the time, but this is a rather extraordinary one, and one that people around the world can understand, because we're talking about a society just like yours. And I think that's why this matters a great deal. I've heard some people say, well, Hong Kong is lost and nothing to talk about it anymore. I think there's a lot to talk about in this regard. If we're going to understand how to guard our basic liberties anywhere, in my view, a human rights violation anywhere is a violation everywhere. And I think that's the key. And then that doesn't mean, well, we just pay attention to the rest of the world and not Hong Kong, because this keeps going on in Hong Kong. People are still being arrested, being prosecuted, being sentenced to long prison terms. And so it is an ongoing concern for Hong Kong and an ongoing concern for the world.
And I think that's a really important key takeaway of the book, you know, coming back to that quote about Hong Kong as a warning, and that, you know, the dramatic case of Hong Kong and the speed at which the changes were implemented, you know, Hong Kong is a lesson about safeguarding these basic liberties for all people, not just Hong Kongers. Now, Michael, I've taken up a lot of your time, but just before you go, can you tell me, what are you working on now?
Mostly about promoting the book.
Okay.
No one told me that when you write a book, that it's almost as big a job. I'm giving, as you know, I gave a whole series, a week long in London. I gave 6 book talks in 7 days. And I gave them, and I like to give them in not just parliaments and before Amnesty International and organizations that are so prominent, but I especially like being able to talk about these issues with the people. I've given it in London in a library in Belsize. We had a book talk that filled the room, in Taiwan in a bookstore organized by Hong Kongers in Exile, with the lovely name, the Nowhere Bookstore. We filled that bookstore as well. It's cute because it's Nowhere or Now Here, however you want to read it. But this is what people in exile fleeing oppression are saying, that they sometimes feel they've fled to nowhere, but they're also now here. So you can be a part of addressing their concerns as well, because especially in the UK, there are lots of exiles from Hong Kong and in the United States as well. So these are concerns that I think are important for people to pay attention to.
Yeah, and I would recommend to everyone checking out Michael's new book, which is Freedom Undone, The Assault on Liberal Values and Institutions in Hong Kong. And as I mentioned earlier, and as Michael mentioned earlier, he does have a previous book about Hong Kong's national security law, and I will put a link to that. It's Making Hong Kong China, The Rollback of Human Rights and the Rule of Law. Just to bring our interview to a close, I'm Jane Richards, and I've been speaking to Michael Davis. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.